might be back on scary stuff. So, also, I'm going to get a mind of Washington.
Go ahead, put the mic up.
Okay, any of you who are, I have to keep it down though, my voice is too loud. So, in academic medicine, there's the old publish and perish thing. I mean, in other words, if you want a job, you have to write something, get it published. It doesn't have to be good, it doesn't have to be relevant, it doesn't have to be useful, it just has to get published. So I wound up publishing lots on the subject of near-death experiences and did research in three areas. One, on suicide. So when I'm not here just flapping my jaws, this is a serious subject to me, one that I have a great deal of experience in clinically, feel very strongly about, enough that I made it a subspecialty. My other subspecialty is frightening experiences, because those are people that don't have a voice. And social workers are good for that, you know, giving voice to the voiceless. And third is children. And if you've read a wonderful book by Melvin Morse called Closer to the Light, then you know that there's only been one research project done with children, and it was Melvin Morse, three physicians, and myself, who for a year studied kids' near-death experiences at Children's Hospital in Seattle. So I have all those reasons to come back, because those are like full-blown, like, pieces of information I want to share with you that, you know, again, last time I was here, I said I could build a little fire and keep you here all night. That's because I'm a storyteller. And for those of you with your hands in the air, like, have no idea who I am, my big claim to fame is that Irma Bombeck died with a book I wrote called After the Light. And her husband called and said that she thought I was the Irma Bombeck of what I do, which was a very wonderful, oh, thank you,
on sale,
my agent.
After the
this time I have books, yay, it's finally in print. Anyway, so for those of you who don't know who I am, my humor is, you're probably getting a good idea. I'm not a serious speaker, I am Irma Bombecki. I'm more Bette Midler-y, I think, than anything. But anyway, even on the subject of suicide, I'm going to inspire and humor you a bit. But this time, I'll be telling other people's stories. Last time I told my own, didn't need notes. This time, maybe I will be behind the podium for a while. That won't last. Okay. For 10 years, set your watch. I worked on this massive critical care unit and just, you know, making my way. I had no idea what I was doing. For those of you who weren't here before, the long and the short of it is I'm from eastern Kansas. I had a hamster named Toto. I had a near-death experience. Toto and I left Kansas, hit a tornado outside of Hays, and wound up in Seattle, Washington, which, by the way, is called the Emerald City. So to say that I have a wardrobe of red shoes is an understatement. I mean, I have so many pairs of red shoes because I am Dorothy. I really am Dorothy. But it's like, what if Dorothy stayed in the Emerald City and never went back and worked it out in Oz? And that's kind of like what I've done with my life. As part of my near-death experience, instead of a life review, I had a life preview. That'll make you crazy because... I chose to come back because of my life preview. I saw myself being of service to others, and I was grown with the green. Eastern Kansas doesn't sound like a wealthy place, but it is. I grew up with, you know, more money than stink. My dad was the senior law partner in what became the largest law firm in the United States, still is. I grew up in a place called Leawood, Kansas, which is in Johnson County. Johnson County is still the third highest income per capita county in the United States. I was raised by pleasant people who weren't home a lot. We did have service, but I didn't give it. I received it. It came uniformed. It was all about me. I was first born, first grandchild, the only child for a number of years, so absolutely the queen of all I beheld. And then along came God. So in this life preview, skipping over lots of other things that happened during my resuscitation, was a preview of me being of service, and that was like, fucked in settings I couldn't imagine being in. Well, it turned out to be medicine, but who knew? In a place I couldn't imagine, because all I knew was where mountains met water. I knew it wasn't Kansas. So, I mean, our highest elevation is called Mont Blanc. It's, you know, like as tall as this room, and it's artificial. And people actually ski down it, kind of. So, anyway, off Toto and I went to the Emerald City, and one thing led to another, and I wound up in medicine. And I'd had a near-death experience, but it was 1977, and I didn't know what the heck had happened. There was no, there was nothing for me, absolutely no map. The term near-death experience hadn't been coined, and so I was being pursued by a demon. See, that's another lecture. I told you I had more to say. But I was also comforted by angels, and these were all things I could see, including way too many dead people. I mean, entirely my patients, for years and years and years, my own patients. One coworker and a fiancé. And, I mean, all this is crazy-making, so I decided that I was a very high-functioning schizophrenic. And I know that standing here talking before you, if you haven't spent any time with me, you're thinking that too. So it's my job to talk you out of that. I'll just have another drink. I'm dehydrated. I'm pretending it's vodka, but now that we have sound, it's water. Well, back to the synopsis. So I'm working away at Harborview, and now it's 1977, April. And I had a patient by the name of Maria. I told her story last time I was here. This is the first chapter in. So here's a little. I have so many book plugs because this is my mission. So I plug this from my heart. But anyway, so chapter one is the Maria story, the shoe on the ledge story. Chapter two is my near-death experience. Chapter three is getting out to the Emerald City. And chapter four is where the demon stuff starts. And chapter five is the suicide stuff, and, you know, on it goes. So I figure you don't have to buy this book. Just keep inviting me down here because, you know, the salary is so generous. I got dinner. I got cornbread and I got pie. So I guess it was generous. Thank you. Anyway, I had so much information by the time I wrote this book on the subject. It was over 1,000 pages long. This had to be distilled down by my editor, William Morrow, to a lot less in terms of pages and is. But the suicide stuff is in here, but primarily not the stories I'm going to tell. So you're getting a little of both. Anyway, I met Maria. Maria was a Hispanic woman. English was so not her first language, her second or third. In fact, she only spoke Spanish. But apart from that, we kind of worked out a deal, communication, and then Maria went in, she flatlined, and I stood in the doorway, watched an easy resuscitation. She came to, skipping over a lot of Espanol. She talked me into going out and checking on a ledge on a different side of the hospital, turned out a different floor entirely, for a large, dark blue shoe. With, you know, the lace going under the heel, just, you know, the little toe scuffed up, in case I got it confused with any other large dark blue tennis shoes on a ledge. No, it's be the one with the scuffed up toe. Okay, got it. So anyway, went out there, got the shoe, became the Shroud of Turin of Harborview. You know, I mean, it was just amazing because Harborview is a teaching hospital, which means you don't get a doctor and a nurse and a respiratory therapist when you code at Harborview or any trauma center in the Salt Lake City area. You get thundering herds. You get students, interns, residents, visitors, fellows, social workers, more students, you know. So all these people had witnessed Maria flatlining. And then here was the shoe that, among other things, she described. It's what I call the shoe heard around the world because it was so highly witnessed. You know, skeptics just are. There's a skeptic in France driving me nuts as we speak, you know, trying to erode the truth. I can't change the truth. She saw the shoe. I got the shoe. Everybody saw the shoe. Well, that sent me off on a path that I remain to this day. And I'm sorry about all the housekeeping, but I'm, like, really thirsty. So I will be drinking. I won't be talking. So This is going to be a particularly interesting part of the audio tape. Me drinking. And then, I decided I was going to ask everybody thereafter two questions because, see, I had an out-of-body experience as well as a life preview and lots of other things that happened. And because I thought I was nuts, it was interesting and a bit comforting to me to meet Maria because I knew she wasn't crazy. And I knew that what she heard in the room was correct, what she saw in her room was correct, what she saw above the emergency room entrance of the hospital was absolutely correct, and hello, then there was a stent issue I'm holding that no way she could have spotted. I mean, I tried the skeptical route. I won't belabor it because I went over that last time I was here, but oy, did I try to like rationally explain away this shoe, and I just couldn't. So I thought, okay, there's two of us. I wonder if there are more. And I was in such a perfect place, this trauma center, to ask the questions that I wanted to ask. But it did boil down to two, and that is, what happened to you? And what do you remember next? So it was either going to be, well, I was in a car accident, and then I woke up here, or I was in a car accident, you're going to think I'm crazy, but then I knew it was going to be juicy. Or, you're not going to believe me, but, and I knew it was going to be juicy. But I didn't hear that for a while. This was April 77. Through April, nothing. I'm getting, well, then I woke up here. Through May, well, then I woke up here. Come June, things changed. And I talked to the first person I'd ever met who, in the course of a suicide attempt, had a near-death experience and came back with her own mission. And I'm going to tell you that story momentarily, but first I want to put us all on the same page, so to speak. That's no reference to the book whatsoever, but I'm going to go back to the mic. Here's what I know about being a clinician and what I know about suicidal people. I don't care if they tried to hurt themselves or not. There are... do I have to help them? I want to go to the podium now. Now I want to walk. Because this is so important. I have to, like, really pound it in. But we also have to keep my dress in mind. But you come and feel like the fabric and note the hem, because this is really a nice one. So there are two kinds of people in the world who have death on their mind. I mean, I'm talking serious death on their mind. The kind that will get you into Harborview Medical Center, into the intensive care unit. They are people who want to die, and then there are people who don't want to live anymore. And there is a big difference in the two. And what brings people to, like, the table of self-destruction, it matters. People who want to die usually are in circumstances, biochemical, environmental, familial, social, romantic. There's many reasons to want to most sincerely end our lives. The people who want to die usually don't want to die. If their needs were met, they wouldn't want to die. It would be okay. People in intractable pain want to die. But if you took their pain away, okay, I'll live. Sometimes the pain is emotional. Sometimes the pain is biochemical. I have talked to people who have attempted suicide. Here's my record, 19 times. And I'm talking, again, if people wind up at Harborview Medical Center, that's not for the wannabes. These are for people who really, 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 really meant it. And I never met anyone that I thought was going to hell. They were all people in various forms of utter despair and despondency because of circumstances that they felt were out of their control. So here's where I put down all mics, because you can't see this on the tape anyway. But look at the visuals. When we're happy, this is not my night. When we're happy, we have body language. You know, you want to be psychic? Learn to read body language. You know, we have a tendency to show how we feel to the world, passive-aggressively or openly, but we get our message across. So if we're happy, you know, our arms are out, we're ready to take on the world. This is how we live life. Hi! Or yay! I mean, all the body language for happiness is out here. But as we get more and more unhappy for whatever reasons, this tightens up. The body language gets smaller. People get more withdrawn. Verbally, emotionally, mentally, physically, they get smaller and smaller and smaller and more insignificant in their heads anyway, and smaller and smaller. And the problems keep pressing in and in to where really it's impossible to make a rational decision. Because now, here's the keyhole. You're down to this. And it says exit. And there is the illusion or delusion, depending on how you want to define it, that dying gets you out of stuff. And people who want to die, I'm still on that category, just really want relief. And I, as an MSW with lots of scientific background on a medical level, promise you that I really, and now I'll tell you my age, I'm 55, so I've been out there practicing for almost, you know, 32 years. Again, I've never met anyone who wanted to die, who really wanted to die, if they could get out of whatever was causing them to really want to die. Sometimes dumb decisions. Sometimes they really didn't know that it was going to be that far, that that was really going to be a lethal injection. It goes on and on. But my point, and I don't care if anybody agrees with me or not, is one of compassion. You know, I don't believe that God, the God I met in my near-death experience, who loved me personally so much and conveyed such love for everybody in the world equally, would take someone so beat up they tried to kill themselves and beat them up some more. That just doesn't even make sense to me. Although I think we do a darn good job of beating ourselves up, and I'm going to be addressing that during this evening. I'm not talking about the near-death experience, I'm just talking about the circumstances that led people to make a poor decision, but one that doesn't result in eternal damnation that I have ever heard. That's just my experience. Then there's another group of people who attempt suicide. Okay, so we have people who want to die. Then we have people who just don't want to live anymore. And again, there's a difference. The people who just don't want to live anymore are tired. They're usually our elderly population, maybe have outlived spouses, even children, sick. You know, Medicare isn't enough. Medicaid is a joke. Fixed income is impossible. Everything hurts. And we were talking about this at dinner. I never did as the fullest research that I could have. I did once a research project looking at how many people died during graveyard shift, which is such a perfect phrase. And it was most of the people died during that shift, during the night. And my hypothesis is that's when we slow down physiologically and we get, you know, closer to there anyway. But also, it leaves people with their thoughts and such. And there was a point I was going to make greater than this, but I guess that's why I didn't do research, because I already forgot it. So, anyway, determining when one dies. So this is what we were talking about at dinner. So I've talked to a number of elderly people over the years who have been very specific about their time of death. And we were at dinner talking about one of my patients said, I didn't work weekends. This was a Friday. I'm saying goodbye to, you know, my cast and crew on the intensive care unit. And this one fellow said, you need to see me by Sunday because I'm going to be dead by the time you get here Monday. I wanted to do that, but too many times I'd done that and been wrong. went to see somebody. Gosh, one of my patients told a graduate student and I that he wasn't going to be alive by the time I got back from lunch. That was the last time I went, because, of course, he was dead when we came back from lunch. And I just stopped. So this guy, I believed him. So I went in to see him Sunday morning, and he died Sunday afternoon. So I do believe that certain people in stage of life, because of disease, because of age, because of something else, they just stop living. I moved from critical care into bone marrow transplant, founded the Department of Social Work and the world's first bone marrow transplant center. To get in the door of Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, you had to be terminal, and you had to be a child in those days. Now you can be an adult or a child, but you still have to be terminal. This is like, because of expense and stress, you have to be really, really sick. And again, one of my patients, upon learning that he had graft versus host disease, which means that the bone marrow transplant didn't take, I swear he just rolled over and died. Just died. It was called heart failure. But this was not an elder person. This was a vital young person. And so I do believe it's within us to check out any time. I also believe that when we're born, we remember everything about where we came from. I'm just preaching back to the religion of Kim. I mean, I'm not saying this is anyone's doctrine. I'm a Lutheran. The other half actually is LDS on my mom's side. So I'm not like completely out of it, but I'm in the book alive under Lutheran. Forgive her. She has people here. Let her in. What was I saying? I'm just, I got to stick to my notes, Kim. I was like not preaching doctrine. Oh, yeah. Dinner conversation. I believe that, I just know in my heart that, well, we're eternal. I saw that in my near-death experience. So we came from somewhere. And I do know that our souls are just so thirsty for knowledge and that we're on our way somewhere else that gets better and better, hopefully. And sometimes we make mistakes. And I think that we get do-overs, just like, on the playground. That, again, a loving, fatherly God is not going to, beat you silly if, you make the mistake of dying before, quote-unquote, your time. Near-death experiencers, almost to the one, have a metaphor for life, and it's school. Okay? The suicide attempters I know who have come back and reported on their experiences call what they went to a lot of times school. Not hellish images, not the light. So with that, I want to give you some, for those of you taking notes, some actual research information, and then start telling you some stories and tell you about people I know. There is someone who has mentored me, inspired me, and everybody else in this field, and then some. His name is Dr. Bruce Grayson. He's one of the founders of the International Association for Near-Death Studies. I'm glad they... That's such a mouthful, IONS, so IONS from now on, because my joke is, who's going to live long enough to keep saying International Association for Near-Death Studies? Then y'all here have to add Salt Lake City, 3 more words. I'd kill myself. So Salt Lake City IONS, Seattle IONS, that's what I referred to. Oh, Bruce Grayson was in on the founding of IONS, and I shouldn't complain about the name because the acronym could have been worse. For the first couple of years, this organization's name was the Association for the Scientific Study of Near-Death Phenomena. Acronym, ASNIPT. It just wouldn't have worked. You would have been, welcome to Salt Lake City ASNIPT. We thank you for coming. Our expenses go directly to... So I won't complain. But anyway, IONS, okay, so if I say IONS, we all know what that means. So Bruce Grayson was one of the 5 people, Raymond Moody, others, at then the University of Virginia, founded IONS. Then he moved around to the University of Michigan, then to University of Connecticut. Then now he's back at the University of Virginia, head of psychiatric services. He's done well in the world. And did, so far, the only, what I'd call, hardcore scientific study of people who attempt suicide and come back. And when I met Dr. Grayson, it was actually 20 years ago last June in Dallas, Texas, at an international conference on suicidology, and we were both presenting on basically the same thing. It's just that he was a doctor, so he got more money for his research project. So I'm going to give his information first, followed by my research, and then we'll really kick it into another gear. So Bruce Grayson's research determined, and this was looking at about 100 to begin with, it's much larger now, but about 100 suicide attempters who survived. He found the following absolute changes upon recovery. One, and these are, in his opinion, in order of what he found, but it's not a big order. It's not extreme. One is a newfound sense of unity with something greater than themselves. Okay, people who are suicidal are often hopeless and feel disengaged from people, from God, from society, from their friends, from money, from health. They don't feel part of anything. It's lonely to be that sad and that full of despair. So coming back, that seems to go away. If you feel united with something, that feels very, very good. That's what we all seek in life. That's what, you know, the basis of friendships, the basis of love, the basis of church and community. So that's the biggie, and that's a real big, wonderful thing to come back with. There's also a sense of belonging in the universe, that there is a place for one, a real place that's been designated, designed, co-designed, co-created. Survivors find it easier to let go of personal problems. Well, that's big, because it's often personal problems that bring them to that point of despair. Survivors of suicide attempts often discover an appreciation for the meaningfulness of life. Again, what could rob you of your joy if you felt meaningless? Now, I have an aging mom, and that's beginning to hit her. And there are some elders here, and, you know, I haven't lived as old as you, but I'm getting your drill through my mom's eyes. You know, suddenly driving has become limiting. Cleaning the house that, you know, I grew up in. When I go home to Eastern Kansas, I go home. My bedroom's there, my bed is there, my furniture is there. I just pray that mom has changed the sheets. And I have no evidence. But I know that life, you know, it's becoming more and more challenging. And if you aren't meaningful, that's depressing. Because even the laziest among us, okay, kids and teenagers don't count. Seek meaning. I mean, we want to attach meaning to almost everything we do. You know, I mean, that's how I rationalize a lot of time I spend in front of the TV watching Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. It's bringing meaning to my life. I'm learning how to dress my husband. You know, it's so that sense of meaningfulness is very important. Ditto, another aspect that suicide attempters come back with, and that is a sense of specialness. Actually, all near-death experiencers come back with that. We're all like so full of ourselves. But actually, God loves me most, so just the line forms behind me. But there is that sense of specialness. It's not ego-based. It's just knowing that we're so darn loved. It's just fabulous. This is big for me. People also come back with a sense of purpose. I would try to kill myself if I didn't have a sense of purpose. I mean, that's maybe just how I'm built, but my sense of purpose right now is my family. I had my first pregnancy. I mean, I gave birth at age 40 and 10 days. You know, and I had a red-hot career going at that time. I've been on Oprah twice. I've been on every talk show on the planet. I mean, traveling. I've been on every continent but Antarctica and South America now. And, you know, I was just special. Back to that sense of specialness that I just mentioned. And then I had a baby and I bailed. You know, and that's, speaking of bailing, giving birth is kind of like being born, I decided to. Because my information from the God that I was with is that our souls are eternal. We came from someplace, we're going someplace. That means that we also had to probably have some arrangement about who we'd be born to, what our potential opportunities might be. And I believe that in the first, until we get language down and can communicate, that we actually might remember this. And the reason I say this is multifold. One reason, real classic hospice story. This was actually in a hospice setting, but the children weren't dying. It was an adult in the house. But a nurse in the East Coast was in the house, and a new baby had been born, and the newborn was in a crib, and the adults in the house, including the nurse, heard the three-year-old climb up the crib, stick her head over and say, "Baby, baby, can you tell me about heaven? I'm beginning to forget." Isn't that amazing? So I think that some people, that we also, I know this is true of me, let me just put this in context of me, that we like maybe volunteer for things that will help us learn, that will help us grow, that will help us be better spirits, if you will, and that, you know, our life here can be used as a way to improve ourselves. And that includes challenges. No one grows if you're not challenged. So I think that we volunteer for certain things, like, okay, I'll do cancer, I'll lose a baby, you know, I'll be a prima gravida, which means too old to have children, and that's what my chart says. You know, all that stuff. But I think some people over-volunteer. I do not buy into the line about when God closes a door, he opens a window. I know too many people who tried to go through the window and died. Sometimes life is just too much. Personally, we were also talking about this somewhere along the line. If life is school, I want recess. No. I want summer vacation. I want a nice long time to play, because life is hard. And sometimes there are people amongst us for whom the challenges are simply too great. And another window doesn't open. The whole house crashes. They just over-volunteered, I'm thinking. I think I over-volunteered. In fact, if we're together on another side, and if there is reincarnation, and I'm going to be sent back, if you see my hand in the air, would you please knock it down and remind me about the summer vacation? You know, because, all right, I'll let my soul rot for a while in inactivity and I won't learn anything. I don't mind. But anyway, if you look at it that way, the whole subject of suicide has shifted from blaming the victim to, again, one of compassion. Okay? But I learned some things in my own research that I added on to Dr. Grayson's that aren't as inspirational as his conclusions, but they're my clinical observations. So in addition to, oh, well, let me finish his, that sense of purpose. There's one more that he came up with, and that survivors of a suicide attempt also believe they have knowledge that their spiritual essence will survive physical death. In other words, no matter who they were, what faith or lack thereof, people come back. This is true of near-death experiencers. If you've been to the other side, you know there's another side. It's kind of a no-brainer. It's not a matter of faith to walk through life if you've had a near-death experience. You know, that's not the big test. It's if you haven't had a near-death experience, you still have to put one foot in front of another and do so in faith. You get kudos for that in heaven. You know, the cheaters got to peek. It's like, you know, we looked at the brochures, if nothing else, and decided Disney World looks like fun and we're going there and have a ticket to ride. All right, but this is what I added on to Dr. Grace's work in addition. One is that I noticed that the problems that made suicide attempters miserable were still there. Their problems, in fact, might have been bigger, because many people who attempt suicide and survive are real unhappy about it and get depressed. Oh my gosh, I have to tell you the most amazing story. So across the street, my suicide patients then would go straight from the intensive care unit, where they were often in restraints, to the third floor of the mental health building. I mean, immediately across the street. They're on the same level. So, you know, my patients could look out the window and see where they're going to be locked up next. And that was depressing, too. So I would go over and see these people, and you get my personality by now. It's kind of a rah-rah cheerleader type. So I was over at the lock-in ward once, and it was like a nightmare. I thought, no wonder people want to kill themselves. I would if I had to be here. Because over the intercom came this cheery nurse's voice and said, we have this thing in Seattle called the Arboretum. It's, you know, acres and acres and acres of like Central Park, maintained by the University of Washington and a lot of volunteers, and it's full of trees and bushes that have labels on it, and it's educational and lovely and beautiful. And so anyway, there was going to be a field trip to the Arboretum, and all those patients wishing to go on the supervised trip to the Arboretum go to the van waiting in front of the building now. But the van could only hold, you know, like 30 people. So you had to hurry on down there, because once the van was filled, everybody, then the van was filled and be staying at the facility. However, the chirpy nurse continued, for those of you who don't make it down to the van and get a seat, we'll be going out to the back and playing volleyball. And I thought, what a boring game of volleyball that's going to be, because that would leave all the depressed people. You know, the manics ran down and got on the bus, of course. Yay, yay, we're going to the Arboretum. Well, the people who were depressed were like, oh boy, I can't, I mean, they don't move. So can you imagine the volleyball game out and back? It's like, hear the chirpy nurses hitting the ball. Bar! I said a bad word, but that's pretty much what they were doing. It was like, swear word. Swear word. Or just, don't care. It was the lamest game that could ever have existed. So anyway, if you're depressed, you don't have a lot of energy. But if you come back from the dead and know that there's really no exit, oh, bummer. Now you're back. Your problems are still there. But you don't have the exit stage right option that existed before the near-death experience. And that's the big oops. So the second conclusion I made is that life was often harder for suicide attempters than it was before, because, for the most part, they did not see death as an option. And that'd be rough. So on they live, and what researchers wrote up for years thereafter is that once someone, and I wrote this up too, in fact, I wrote it in this book. Don't write anything. My advice, nothing is definitive. But I wrote with great confidence in this book that I'd never met anyone who in the course of a near-death experience attempted suicide again. I have since. And that leads to the stories. I also then noticed one last thing. As I heard about near-death experiences from people who had attempted suicide, I kept, after a while, it was kind of like, it was green-gray, it was blue-gray, it was purple-gray, it was gray-gray, it was white-gray, it was dark-gray, it was light and gray. A lot of gray. And so I began to make note, and I came up with 100%. Now, I don't think that has gone the distance, because I stopped doing that, you know, once I could publish something. But at the time, I was doing that kind of a nose count. Every suicide attempter that I came across went to what I just began to call the grayness. It wasn't the light. It wasn't the dark. But it involved gray. Sometimes it was only building material. Sometimes it was everything. So that's page one. Yeah, that's page one. When I get to the stories, there are no pages, and I just get going. So there was, well, no, I'm not, well, wait, what did I decide to do here? Okay, I'm going to do what I said I would do and not go off script. All right. There are a lot of people, you don't have to raise your hands again, but if you are a loved one of someone who attempted suicide and didn't come back, then you know that hurts a lot. It actually becomes a gene code. How scary is that? A parent who commits suicide leaves a legacy of 50% chance that children born to that person will commit suicide. That's like 50% is a great big statistic. Okay. As they say, though, suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. I have never met a suicide attempter who really, really, really didn't feel strongly about not doing that again, even if they did it again. Okay? I'm busting to tell you one story. I'm up here. I don't work alone. I'm going to go for it. Okay, so I could see demons and I could see angels and I could see dead people until the fifth month of my pregnancy with my daughter Rebecca, which was 14 years ago. And then I was looking at this angel on a piano and I turned to my friend and said, "The baby's here," because that was the first time I felt Rebecca inside of me. And then I turned back and I could sense the angel, but I couldn't see the angel with my eyes anymore. And that's been the case since then. I've decided that I wouldn't be a very good parent if I could see angels and demons and dead people because I stop on a dime. I mean, I couldn't possibly drive. You know, I mean, I'd be wrapped around a pole. I mean, we're talking angels here, prostrate. So when I say I'm not up here working alone, sometimes I get really weird, and I'm entering weirdom right now. I'm just giving you a heads up. It's not like I can hear voices. If you can. I can't. Quiet, you tell the stories. No, you're doing a good job. So I'm going to tell you a story that I'm feeling inspired to tell you. Ah, oh, there's the word. Shut up already. Okay, I'm telling the story. Leave me alone. Out. All right. Mark Herod. These are real people with real names, except for one case, and I'll tell you when that happens. Mark Herod. The last time I saw Mark Herod was in my kitchen. Sadly, he was dead. And it wasn't that long ago. 5 years ago, Mark Herod committed suicide. For the umpteenth time. Well, eighth, to be honest. Obviously, Mark had issues. One, his last name was Herod, as in Herods in England, in London. That family has more money than the Queen, or did before they sold it to the father of the guy who was with Princess Di when she died. I mean, I digress. But the American family got squat because, you know, they went against the crown and all that. And so Mark's family grew up in Texas, quite poor and, you know, resenting the rich kin across the pond. And he also had terrible health problems. He was one of those people that was allergic to everything, you know, and it would take his breath away, go into anaphylactic shock. And I mean, bees, insect spray, mold. I mean, you know, let's move to Seattle because there's no mold there. Suicidal people, what are you going to do with them? So Mark also could make, he had an ex-wife. When I met him, he had an ex-wife, a fiance. Well, no, he wasn't engaged yet, but he was about to become engaged. And a daughter who was a late teen. And he was still involved with his first family, and very involved with his girlfriend. And when I met him, he was happy. Life was working out for him. He had found a way to pull down some pretty good money by doing high-rise construction work. You know, you get paid by the floor after 50 floors or something. I mean, you know, for tall buildings. And he was a riveter and did all kinds of things on this, you know, doing this balancing act without vertigo. So money was coming his way. He was in love. and his suicidal ideations stopped. They had stopped anyway because he had had a near-death experience. One thing that Mark really, really, really hated, I feel like so separate from the back row, by the way. If you ever want to move, I didn't even see you back there. Well, you know, unless you're in a wheelchair, just come on down. You can stay there, because otherwise it's, you know, turbulence. Oh, there's your seat. But otherwise, if you want to come forward, I just hate separation. And so, gosh, move in. I just noticed there were cheap seats. I hope they charge you less for sitting back there, because, you know, I'm this big to you. I need screens. I'll project my image. You can see me closer. And then you'll want to die. So, Mark had a near-death experience, and Mark had a near-death experience in his seventh suicide attempt, or eighth. And what Mark really hated was school. He liked his job as a high-wire act because he was outside. Well, think Texas, you know. He was just that way. He almost died. One night was in his rental house and failed to note the landlord was going to plug every hole and blow insecticide in to get rid of some bees. I mean, Mark almost died again. And if you're suicidal, you have control. It's called locus of control. But if something else is going to get you, you know, I want to live. You know, it's a control issue. Well, Mark really wanted to live when the bug spray was coming in, and he almost died again. But he so hated school, loved what he was doing, made a suicide attempt again, and was taken by an angel to a place where he was told he would go if he ever tried to commit suicide again. And what it was school. And for Mark, that was hell. It really was hell. We're talking, you know, cubbies and desks and chairs and lectures and reading. School in all its sense. And how he perceived the school was in a huge building. It was enormous. But the angel just sort of made the side of the building disappear so that Mark could look in to the hundreds upon hundreds of, well, countless numbers of people bent over in school doing homework. And he was told those were people who had attempted suicide, and that's where he would go if he attempted again, to school. Mark made a mistake. Be very careful about interpreting visions. I mean, don't ask me to, anyway. And don't ask Mark to, ever, because the way he interpreted that was a mistake. He decided that that's where all people who attempted suicide went. And for a while, he went around to people saying, if you try to kill yourself, you're going to go to this big building and you're going to sit at a little desk and learn stuff, and it's hell and it's terrible. And the angel actually came back to Mark when he was in perfect health and said, listen, son, you're scaring people, and that's not God's plan. That was what was going to happen to you. But that doesn't mean it's going to happen to anybody else. You know, you have no knowledge of this. So cease and desist. So Mark actually did get back to everybody he had contacted and said, I was wrong. And that took years. That was his mission. Then when we met up, he began attending Seattle Ions, got really involved with our group. And on television, I called him Little Jesus because he looked like the classic, you know, image of Jesus of Nazareth on TV. He didn't in person so much, but the camera captured that. And there's nothing like a stereotyped Jesus figure saying, don't attempt to hurt yourself, you know, to get attention. So I carted him out like, you know, my carry-on luggage. I put him on every television show possible because he was very, very effective at saying, don't hurt yourself. Well, Mark's fiance had other plans for their relationship, like she wasn't going to be in it. And even as adults, you know, we get hurt and make decisions out of despondency. And Mark's fiance's name was Dawn, like the sun coming up.
One day, she woke up, and Mark came over at the beginning of the day and said, "Goodbye. I'm going to kill myself." Well, that really wasn't what she wanted to hear. And she also didn't believe him because he was so anti-suicide. So, but you have to take someone who's threatening seriously. And she was willing to do that, so she called a mutual friend. And they began to drive around that part of King County looking for Mark, and she began to have visions. And in her visions, she saw him on a metal, like, rod, or, you know, like a metal long piece, and decided that he was on top of new construction and was going to leap to his death. Okay? So she started calling, this is in a place called Kirkland, Washington. She started calling the Kirkland police. They did not want to hear from Don. For a while during the day, they did go out and check out places of new construction, but they didn't find Mark. And her calls became bothersome to them. Well, came time, you know, evening. Now we go back to... I don't have this story in the can, by the way. If I'm putting you to sleep, I'm sorry. I wasn't even going to tell you this story. I'm nudged up here, so somebody is going to be benefiting from what I'm about to tell you. Well, I hope everybody is. So I am minding my own business, talking to my daughter Jennifer, who, you know, was like in her late teens at that time, had nothing to do with Mark or anything. So here we have, like, you know, here's our kitchen plan. I'm standing here. Jennifer is like there in my sight. We have a little kitchen TV that's on, but on mute. And then there is Mark Harrod standing in the kitchen telling me that he has died on the railroad tracks in Kirkland, Washington. Really specific information. And when I say Mark appearing there, I mean Mark appearing there. Not like a ghostie. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, all silvery and shimmery and woo, you know, Halloween-y. It was his essence. It's back to that. It was his personality. It was Mark as sure as anything. You know, I knew it was Mark. I had such confidence that I freaked out. Because Mark's not supposed to be in my kitchen. And I didn't know what to do, so I called our mutual friend, who I didn't know had been driving around looking for Mark. And I said, you know, Mark's dead on the railroad tracks in Kirkland, Washington, and what do you think I should do? How crazy is this? So he said, well, I'm going to call Dawn and tell her, because she's been having these visions all day of Mark walking on this metal beam, thinking he was on a high rise, but the metal beam was actually a railroad track. And he said, I think you should call the Kirkland police. Well, you know, I whine with the best of them, and I went into full whine mode because I, you know, I didn't want to call the Kirkland police, to tell you the truth. So I did. I got treated as you might expect, with disdain and dismissive tones. And it was, you know, this woman, and I wanted to smack her, actually. It was like, yes, we know about the Harrod case. No, we haven't. So I said, you know, I didn't say he just was in my kitchen, but they already had one wacko dame on the phone, and they just were getting another one, you know, another voice. And she had no patience with me whatsoever. And finally, very, very disdainfully, she said, I can't even get my voice to do this, but she said, ma'am, if somebody were dead on the Kirkland Railroad tracks, the Kirkland police would know it. Well, a loving God also came into my kitchen at that time in the form of a woman named Jean Anderson, Channel 5 in Seattle's anchor person, breaking news. Okay, the TV was on mute. Our television on mute puts captioning on automatically, so I could read everything. So I'm on the phone hearing the sheriff's department dispatcher saying, you know, the Kirkland police would know if someone was dead on the Kirkland railroad tracks. And Jean Anderson is, you know, like closed captioning saying, they're breaking news that somebody has died on the Washington Dinner Train railroad tracks in Kirkland, Washington. And so I had the great joy of saying, well, I suggest that the Kirkland police get down to the Kirkland Railroad tracks because Jean Anderson and Channel 5 are already there with the news. It was a finer moment. I love being right. I'm so bad at that. I mean, that's why it's going to be my beaten up, because I love being right way too much. I'm attached to being right. Wait a minute. I'm a mother. I am right. So, the police go, I'm thinking the absolute worst. I'm married to a paramedic in the Seattle Fire Department. People who get hit by trains get picked up with shovels. I'm sorry, but there's a lot of... It's a violent death. They're hit by a train. Imagine a car, and then make it big. So I had the worst thought scenario going on, and, you know, it was tragic, and I thought, he knew what he was doing. He absolutely knew what he was doing. He made a cognitive decision to kill himself, knowing that if he tried that again, he would succeed and he would go to school. Something, well, the loss of a love made the pain of life greater than the pain of school. And he made an active choice. But boy, was that not the end of it. Oh my gosh. So, the next thing I find out, his family, his wife and daughter come to me for grief counseling. About 6 or 7 weeks later. If you've been in grief, you know that it's actually not that bad for the first 6 weeks because you get all this attention. And there's so much busy work and all this. And then at about 6 to 8 weeks, people go back to their lives. And that's pretty much when the denial wears off and the reality of the loss hits and people aren't there for you any longer, for the most part. Sad but true. So that was the case for them. And they came to get some counseling, but also tell me the most amazing story. So here's the deal. For one, there wasn't a mark on Mark's body. People who get hit by trains, especially if their name is Mark, get body marks. I mean, a train... Yeah, you're sliced to bits. Thank you. We can go horror story on this. You know, how many people do you know on the news who, you know, person hit by train and lives? Well, it has happened. Actually, one of my alcoholic patients passed out on the train tracks downtown. And, you know, people who are that alcoholic don't die. There is no blood flow. It's all, you know, alcohol. They live forever. It's like being in formaldehyde. They live forever. You know, if you really want longevity, start drinking. Preservatives work. Grain alcohol. So anyway, this guy was so drunk, he passed down on the train tracks, and the train cut off his lower legs, and he should have actually died, bleeding to death, talking femoral arteries. But someone was there to assist and do tourniquets, and he lived. By the way, never drank again. Well, I guess if you're hit by train, that's instant sobriety. You know, talking about God will get you. So anyway, but it's usually non-survivable. But they said there wasn't a single mark on Mark's body, A. So to put this in logical terms, the train department decided that even though the engineer said Mark was on the tracks, they're going to, like, they can't explain that medically. So the Washington Dinner Train Company decided that Mark had stepped off the tracks at the last minute. And then when trains go by, they usually are going kind of fast, and there's a rush of air, and you get sucked into it. And he probably hit the train, had a head injury, whatever, died side of the tracks. But the engineer kept saying, but he was on the tracks. He was on the tracks. He didn't, you know, I was there blowing the whistle. He was on the tracks. That was one thing. Second thing is, that same train engineer already had written his suicide note, had a gun in his car. The train was on its way back to Renton, Washington. He was going to, in train terms, put the train to bed, go up to Tiger Mountain above Seattle, already had the place picked out, put a gun to his head, and kill himself. But the train engineer saw how people reacted to Mark's death. Total strangers. Medics. There was one physician on the train. Everyone was very upset, even without a mark on his body, I guess. Anyway, it's very traumatic. People cried, and his family came down, and his body had already been removed, but the engineer was still there and watched, you know, the family's reaction. And he decided he would not kill himself that night, but that he would never kill himself. And he finally got up the nerve to write to the police and ask them to forward this to Mark's family, and that in Mark's name, he promised he would never, ever try to hurt himself. So because of Mark's death, someone lived. And this fellow had a family who was dependent on him with more kids than Mark had. I mean, he was the breadwinner in his family. Mark's daughter was leaving the home. So he saved a life. And then the other thing, then more time goes on, but not much. I got a call pretty quickly after that from his wife and then his daughter and then his fiance, and they'd all had dreams from Mark. And Mark said, basically, you're not going to believe this, but I'm out of school, because he was about to die anyway. He was going to soon come in contact with some substance that was poisonous to his body and die. And so his time in school turned out to be really short in terms of earth time. And Mark and others who have attempted suicide and have talked to me anyway have concluded that you stay in school until the time of your natural death. Now, for people who kill themselves because of a terminal illness, that's not real long on the clock, okay? For people who are older and kill themselves, that's probably not long on the clock. There are people who are younger who kill themselves. It would look like they have a long life ahead of them, like Mark. He wasn't that old, but yet he didn't have a long time ahead of him. We don't know when our appointment is. We don't know. For those of you who have lost loved ones to a suicide, for all you know, their natural death would have been minutes, hours, days, weeks, months, not years. I mean, very soon after that event. You don't know. How can you possibly know? Again, a loving God is going to take care of all that for us. Fear not is my bottom line message. Everything works out in the end. Okay? So that's the big story on Mark Herod. And I wasn't going to tell you that because it wasn't all that long ago. And this is, and there are people here who also... You said we were like Salt Lake City Ions and Seattle Ions were like sister organizations. There are people actually who are here who commute between the two cities and the two groups. And I'm using names of people that, you know, you're going to like meet others who know these people in Seattle. So anyway, that's the story of Mark. And that's just about as good as it gets for me. There are some people in this grayness that perceive themselves in hellish environments, not because God's beating them up, but because they're beating themselves up. Ergo, the case of Patty. I actually know a Patty, all who are suicide attempters, who I'm going to talk to you about next. Here's a hint. Don't name a kid Patty. Already have. How depressing. No, I just noticed that on the plane. I thought, I mean, I believe in using real names. These are people who gave their lives so that I could fulfill their mission, basically, you know, to talk to you and encourage you. So, you know, I want to use their names. So anyway, Patty. So back to Maria and the tennis shoe. So I'm now asking questions of people. What happened to you, and what do you remember next? And it was zip until Patty. Patty was 16. She became 17 in the intensive care unit. Kids that age don't get admitted to Harborview Medical Center. They go to Children's Hospital. But the closest medical facility to Patty's dying body was Harborview. So she was admitted. Patty's body was dying because of an overdose of barbiturates. Patty was a teenager. Need I say more? Anyway, and her boyfriend broke up with her. And she was in WUV. And so she decided the only way to get out of her teenage angst, which was, you know, ratcheting up every time she talked to a girlfriend about the bum, she decided that she would kill herself. You know, that would show him, and she would be out of the pain. It was, you know, a dumb decision made by an adolescent. Again, not held responsible. You know, these are not responsible decisions that suicide attempters make. They're really not. I just want to keep pounding that in. Don't blame the victim, and they're the victims of lots of circumstances that are very complicated. For Patty, it was pretty simple, though. He dumped me, I'm dying. Her mom was at work and just got the strangest feeling that she should go home. Now, this is a story I belabor in After the Light. You're getting the Speaking Kim version. But anyway, her mom went home with this really uncomfortable feeling about something wrong and found Patty's body. That's the only reason she lived. So Patty's admitted as a suicide attempt, overdose. She had a lot of organ problems that kept her with a tube in and not talking. But as soon as the tube was pulled and she could talk, I asked her those two questions. And, you know, what happened? Well, I got that story. And then, you know, what do you remember next? And instead of, well, then I woke up here, which is what I'd gotten since Maria for 2 months, it was, oh, well, I ran into my oompa. You know, and I wasn't familiar with that term, oompa. Well, oompa was the name of her grandfather to Patty when her grandfather died when she was age 2 and hadn't learned to talk very well. A 2-year-old sat behind me on the plane, by the way, coming in. So I was thinking of this story because 2-year-olds know language. They talk a mile a minute. It's just that there aren't many words involved. You know, if your parents or grandparents chatter, 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 but it's, you know, this little girl was like, you know, can we give her something to quiet her down? I had, I had nothing. I had no passengers on either side of me. And you know, it wasn't Southwest Airlines, so I could actually stretch out. And this little girl was this yak, 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 yak. You know, 1, 9, 5, B, A. Just incessant talk. But I'm telling you this story as an aside because it wasn't clear language until we took off. And so, you know, I had a half an hour because I was in row 34, so we boarded first. So I had like a half an hour of this incessant 2-year-old, yakety 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 yakety, not speaking anything understandable, but you kind of get where she was going. And I talked to her mom, and yes, this is our little 2-year-old, and yes, obviously she's trying to learn language, but other than, you know, simple words like A and B and mama and dada, that was pretty much it. But she hasn't spoken really clearly in a sentence. And then we took off in the plane, and we hit kind of a little bump because we were around mountains too. Clear as a bell and very loud, this little girl went, "My God!" Now, we think she was really saying, "What's that?" Because her mother just couldn't go there, but it was the funniest thing. It just was, you know, like, cracked us all up. So when Patty was 2, Oompa was Grandpa, and Oompa died still as Oompa. So Patty overdoses and runs into Oompa, and Oompa is in proportion to her height as she would be at age 2. And he had a rocking chair, and he pulled Patty up on his lap and rocked her lovingly, like a little child, and said, "Don't do this. You know, it's okay. It's just not your time. And you got to get back, and no boy is worth it," kind of stuff. The kinds of things that a living grandfather would say. He was all Oompa. It brought such comfort and love. There is no better person for a little kid than a grandpa. And I'm a grandma. But, you know, I bow to my husband. We have a 3-year-old grandson. You know, grandpas at a certain age are it. And this Oompa was it for Patty. And she came back. And what did Patty do with the rest of her life? She was like Mark and little Jesus. At that time, there was a terrible problem in Seattle with teen suicide. It was out of control. It was contagious. And it was going on in Planco, Texas, too. And who knew why those two communities? So I took Patty to every high school we could get to because it was one thing for me to be yapping to adolescents about don't hurt yourself, you know, over grades over colleges, over teachers, over friends, and over loves. Because, you know, in 2 weeks you're going to be over it. And, you know, loss is loss. I mean, it's one thing for me to go yammer, yammer, yammer. A friend of ours, son committed suicide when he didn't get into the Marines to serve his country in Desert Storm 10 years ago. He still wanted to die for his country. I mean, you know, you can't blame somebody for hurting themselves. They're just, if he had lived a little longer, he would have been really glad he didn't go. You know, because a cousin of his got exposed to something biochemical and has headaches that, you know, won't go away, blah, 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 blah. You know, so don't we wish he had hung around a little longer? But anyway, Patty, until she grew too old for the job, was the perfect ambassador for adolescents, though. And she could say, hey, I did this. And my oompa came, and she was so believable, so heartfelt, that I'd like to think she made a difference. But that was her mission. Lost track of her now. In the book, her name's Penny. There are two people I couldn't find when I wrote this book. Penny Byers is really Patty Byers. I'm just telling you that. For the tape, too, I guess I just outed Patty. All right. That was an example of someone. Yes. What time is it? I don't even know. It's about 10 minutes. We'll end at 9. We'll end at 9. I'm going to, like, take time for video setup back. I wanted to end at 8:30, tell you the truth. But I'll go to 9 if that's okay. Anyway, that's an example of when someone attempts suicide and they meet a deceased loved one, which happens plenty. There are people, though, who attempt suicides and have hellish experiences, but they don't go to hell. They skirt hell. And actually, we're going to see some of this on this video. The case of another Patty, but this is a mature woman. She was married to the sheriff in a town north of Seattle, a couple of counties. And she was really excited one New Year's Eve because her husband was going to come home. He was going to be off duty. She had a bottle of white wine. She was dressed nicely. It was New Year's Eve. She wanted a romantic time with her husband because her marriage hadn't been so hot. She was, you know, her New Year's Eve resolution was going to be to improve the marriage. And he came home and announced that he was leaving her, A. B, he was leaving her for a man, which in a small community is a scandal of unbearable proportions. You can't hide in a small town from that. And C, it was her fault. She was emotionally abused. Anyway, he blamed her for everything, and she believed him. So here's how much Patty wanted to die. She shot herself in the chest, she cut her wrists, and she took a bottle of aspirin drinking the white wine. Not in that order. She was drinking white wine, and that wasn't doing it fast enough. She cut her wrists. Cutting your wrist, by the way, is an ineffective way to die. You scab. So she figured that out, and then she shot herself in the chest. Then she found herself thinking, well, this isn't what she planned on. She was thinking oblivion, and instead she was thinking and thinking and thinking and then thinking and thinking and sinking. And now sinking and sinking some more. And it was like the weight of her own thoughts was pressing her down in the body position as she had left herself on the bed. Okay? It was like she was on her back, slowly, slowly, slowly descending, weighed down by her problems, weighed down how everything was her fault, weighed down by her husband's opinion of her, about the town's opinion of her. About, I mean, you know, the mind is an enemy at times. Her mind was telling her everything bad in her life and that it was all her fault. And she was literally weighed down by it. And then she kind of gently came to her feet and she was surrounded by gray everything. Now, whereas Patty was kind of in gray mist with Oompa, where this Patty found herself was at the bottom of a chasm. And she could look up to a gray sky, monochromatic gray cliffs. It was a kind of a tight place. Gray ground, gray enormous gates, big dark gray lock. And she was, it was just like, you know what I mean by put upon her? She just had the knowledge that these were the gates of hell. So she decided, in her depressive, self-depreciating, suicidal thought pattern that that's where she belonged, and that's why she was there. So she did what I would never do, even under those circumstances. I killed myself, ergo, these are the gates of hell, and I must go in. So she very purposefully walks over to, didn't have a sign about the gates of hell, but, you know, she just knew it was the gates of hell. And she tried to open the gates. Well, they were locked because of this chain and big lock. So then, again, wouldn't do this myself. She began to shake the gates and shout out for assistance. Someone let me in, you know, because she belonged there. She really and truly believed that she belonged there. No, 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 came another opinion. Something happened behind her that caught her attention. She, to this day, doesn't know what exactly. It went so fast after that. But she spun around, and there stood a beautiful man, a beautiful, radiant man. And all she remembers saying is, "My Redeemer." And he said, "Patty," in the most loving, loving terms, said, "Patty, I already did this for you." And she was back. Now, she had to deal with the gunshot wound to the chest. She had to deal with her scabbing wrists. But you know that there was no alcohol or drugs in her system when they did a scan, blood work? None. She drank a bottle of wine and took as many pills as she could swallow before she decided that wasn't working fast enough. Absolutely nothing. You know, she likes to trot around her, like, lab results. I mean, this is a woman who comes to Seattle Alliance. This is someone who, you know, very happy to share her story. Again, though, the same thing. Somebody, if you're of a certain belief system, has died for you already. And so you can't do it again. There, no one gets lost. We get forgiven. We get understood. We get loved. That's not to say everybody go home and hurt themselves because you might die. There are consequences. Stay alive would be my, you know, for reasons that will become evident by the end of this film. But I wanted to tell you that story because that was like kind of hellish. It's just that, well, somebody died for Patty, so all that rattling on the gates was for nothing. Then, in opposition to that, though, I have never talked to a near-death experiencer who went into the light. Closest I've come is seeing the light. And by the light, I'm talking about the light of God. I'm talking about God, pure and simple. Creator, Father God, Mother God, whatever, it doesn't matter. Bubba, I said last time I was here, with a certain degree of reverence. It doesn't matter because there's no name. And the light itself isn't even God. It's like the light of God, in my opinion. And I speak from my own near-death experience. We had a long time in the light. And then in 1980, another time in the light. It's like, when am I going to figure out my life so I can stop dying and just get on with my life? So, anyway, this light is so magnetic. That's all one wants. So here's my other story about Patty, Patty, and Pat. So Pat was like, had to be related to Patty because she almost did the same thing. She shot herself in the chest over, I don't even remember what right now. Offhand, I don't remember what. You know, she was depressed. Depressed. You can speak up any time you want. Don't listen to this man. You talk any time. You just come up here and talk to me. Oh, well, okay, he can tell you to be quiet then, if you're related. But don't be. I override. Anyway, so just as I've never talked to anyone who's gone straight to hell because of a suicide attempt. Maybe I've seen hellish images, but not gone there. Big difference. Also, I've never talked to anybody who's been allowed to enter the light. Pat, having shot herself, and you know, it's odd, women do not usually commit violence against themselves. It just happens to be these stories that I'm thinking of up here. Anyway, Pat was met by her own grandmother, who blocked her way from, this light. It seemed to be coming out of a door at an angle, you know, like this. It wasn't head-on like headlights. But it was the light, and Pat wanted to get there, and Grandma was not going to stop her. So she thought, I can dance around this old lady. Well, no, because Granny in her death was spry. And didn't look like granny either. We're back to essences. Looked like a young, vital person, which is kind of what happens on the other side, including with suicide attempters. If you're old, you feel young. If you're young, you feel older. We, you know, like at one's prime, if you're going to get any visuals. Anyway, grandma was not the person she was when she died at an old age. She was appearing young and could keep up with Pat quite well. So Pat would go, basically, look, you know, and try to get around. And there'd be grandma again, and she just kept saying, Pat, the light is not for you. You have to go back and deal with your problems. The light is not for you. So that's the other side of it. And it kind of gets back to this grayness in school. And so then what happens if an atheist makes a suicide attempt? Well, if you listen to skeptics, you get what you expect in a near-death experience. Well, wrong. I've never talked to anybody who got anything they expected. I sure didn't. None of the people I've talked about have. So I actually know 5 atheists who've had near-death experiences, but one of them was a suicide attempt. Well, this person was an overdose on linoleum cleaner. Only an atheist would do that. What a completely non-thinking thing. Not to disparage atheists. God loves everybody, but, you know, gosh, could it be more gentle? Well, he lived, but he saw lots and lots of colors. And a place that he referred to as the blueness, or the blue, to this day. The only problem for an atheist having a near-death experience is that it kind of knocks the pins out of atheism. And, you know, he was a committed atheist. He was really ticked at God. I wrote this story up, not in After the Light, but for a publication elsewhere, because this guy was just so funny. He tried so hard to cling to his atheism. I mean, he was committing suicide because he really believed there was nothing. And he got, like, big, gorgeous blue. I mean, he didn't even get, like, punished. You know, he had a blast. He had a great time. Again, came back with the, I think I'm going to reevaluate things, but it took a while for him to go, okay, I guess if I know there's an afterlife, I can't be an atheist, but then what I'm going to be? And, you know, no offense, but Latter-day Saint never came to his mind, so he's still out there knocking around looking for his place. You know, it just didn't work for him with the LDS version of living a sin-free life. By the way, ain't no sin. I will, like, go up against anybody. I don't care who they are in the church. There is no sin in committing suicide, which is a real non-Catholic thing to say. I think the greater sin is just not being with God. But if you attempt to kill yourself, you're with God. Ergo, you're not sinning. I mean, it's just a bad idea. But, again, this hell and damnation stuff drives me nuts. So what happens if children attempt suicide and have a near-death experience and come back? Because I've talked to those people too. You know, why in God's green earth would a child want to die? So there's the case of Kay Sear, who was 7 when she attempted suicide by getting on her brother's skateboard, curling up, and going downhill so that she'd ram her head into a cement wall. You know, 7 years of age. Had a near-death experience. She's all grown up now. Fabulous woman. Fabulous. Grounded. Well-spoken. And has the same message that I do. She was on Donahue and some other shows saying, I did this at age 7. Don't do it. Not even a 7-year-old gets out of it. I mean, I'm back to life, but again, it's like school, but it's not what you're being taught. It's not you go to hell for all eternity because you killed yourself. And she talked about her experience as a 7-year-old and being met by someone. Yes? Okay, what about the Columbine murders and the boys that shot themselves? And, of course, took other people with them. Well, here's the thing. You haven't heard this lecture from me yet. I have so many reasons to come back. And one of them is the life review. And my guess is that they're in school. Now, again, a loving God. I'm not saying there isn't judgment, but not the kind you might expect. But in the life review, among other things, we get to experience how we affect other people's lives. And it's a ripple effect without diminishing results. And how, like, so if I I kill you, no matter how I die, eventually I get to feel how you felt, your fear, your whatever was going on. But, you know, if you're with loved ones who are grieving for you, then I got to go through all that too, for as long as that energy exists. So for the Columbine killers who then killed themselves, you know, as long as there's energy as a result of their actions, they're going to be a part of it. School. The whole idea is to learn not to hurt each other or ourselves. It's a mistake. It's a mistake. I'm not God. I don't have to sort it out. Phew. I am so glad. But I also know that God is a lot more loving than we often give credit to God. God will work it out. Also, we don't know what happens at a person's death. That's between that person and God. You know, those kids, or one of them even, might have said, forgive me. I mean, you know, and that's up to the Lord, not us. I try not to judge. That means I have to pray for Osama bin Laden. I have to pray for Saddam Hussein every night. I have my prayer list. I go through it all. Gotta. I ask, though, also in the Lord's Prayer, to be delivered from evil. So, you know, that's my little caveat. So I just say pray for people. Pray for people alive and dead.